the catchphrase, the rich get richer, and its implied, but usually unstated, corollary, the poor get poorer, to characterize this process. Or, as so articulately put by Jesus, according to the Gospel of Matthew in the New Testament, for everyone who has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what he has, will be taken from him. This surprising declaration has been used by some fundamentalist Christians and others as justification for rampant capitalism, a sort of anti-Robin Hood slogan supporting the idea of taking from the poor to give to the rich. But while Jesus' remarks are a good example of preferential attachment, the quote is, not surprisingly, taken out of context. It is often conveniently forgotten that Jesus was actually referring to knowledge of the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, and not to material wealth. He was expressing a spiritual version of the very essence of diligent study, knowledge accumulation, and research and education, as expressed by the ancient rabbis. He who does not increase his knowledge decreases it. The first serious mathematical consideration of preferential attachment was made by Udny Yule, a Scottish statistician who in 1925 used it to explain the power law distribution for the number of species per genus of flowering plants. The modern socio-economic version of preferential attachment, or cumulative advantage, is due to Herbert Simon, and is consequently nowadays referred to as the Yule-Simon process. Simon, by the way, was an extraordinary polymath and one of the most influential social scientists of the 20th century. His research ranged across the fields of cognitive psychology, computer science, economics, management, philosophy of science, sociology, and political science. He was a founding father of several important scientific subdisciplines whose influence has gained great prominence in recent years, including artificial intelligence, information processing, decision-making, problem-solving, organization theory, and complex systems. He spent almost his entire academic career at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh and received the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics for his seminal work on decision-making processes in economic organizations. The empirical and theoretical analyses of business diversity presented earlier show that all cities exhibit the same underlying dynamics in the development of their business ecology as they grow. Initially, small cities with a limited portfolio of economic activities need to create new businesses and functionalities at a fast rate. These basic activities constitute the economic core of every city, big and small. Every city needs lawyers, doctors, shopkeepers, tradesmen, administrators, builders, etc. As cities grow and these basic core activities become saturated, the pace at which new functionalities are introduced slows down dramatically, but never completely ceases. Once the set of individual building blocks is large enough, the resulting combination of talents and functions is sufficient to generate novel variations that expand the business landscape, giving rise to specialized establishments such as exotic restaurants, professional sports teams, and luxury stores, leading to greater economic productivity. Although the theory cannot predict how specific business types rank in individual cities, why, for instance, doctors are first in New York but seventh in San Jose, it does predict how their rankings change as cities grow. The general rule is that business types whose abundances scale superlinearly with population size systematically rise in their rankings, whereas those that scale sublinearly systematically decrease. For instance, at the coarsest level of the NAICS classification scheme, traditional sectors such as agriculture, mining, and utilities scale sublinearly. The theory predicts that the rankings and relative abundances of these industries decrease as cities get larger. On the other hand, Informational and service businesses such as professional, scientific and technical services, and management of companies and enterprises scale superlinearly and are consequently predicted to increase disproportionately with city size, as observed. As a concrete example, consider the number of lawyers' offices. This scales superlinearly with an exponent close to the canonical 1.15, meaning that there are systematically more lawyers per capita in larger cities. The preferential attachment model predicts that, as a city grows, the ranking of lawyers should increase as an approximate power law with an exponent of about 0.4, as observed. Such predictions can be made for any business type at any level of granularity. Thus, the scaling exponents that relate how the abundances of each business category scale with city size capture the disproportionate growth of different business sectors and parameterize them in a more systematic way than simple counts of businesses or expert judgments on the nature of sectors, which are very often quite subjective. A critical aspect of this approach is that cities and businesses are complex adaptive systems and should consequently be viewed as an integrated system and not as isolated individual agents. By looking at all cities and the complete set of business sectors that constitute the entire urban economy in a country, this analysis couples the economic fabric of each city with that of the entire system of cities. 12. Growth and the metabolism of cities. A major theme running throughout this book is that nothing grows without the input and transformation of energy and resources. This was the fundamental basis for the comprehensive theory that I presented in Chapter 4 for quantitatively understanding the growth of biological systems, whether of individual organisms or communities. Recall the basic idea. Food is consumed, then digested and metabolized into a usable form that is transported through networks to supply cells, where some is allocated to the repair and maintenance of existing cells, some to replace those that have died, and some to create new ones that add to the overall biomass. This sequence is the basic template for how all growth occurs, whether for organisms, communities, cities, companies, or even economies. Roughly speaking, incoming metabolized energy and resources are apportioned between general maintenance and repair, including replacement of what's already there and has decayed, and the creation of new entities, whether cells, people, or infrastructure, that add to the system and increase its size. Thus, the energy available for growth is just the difference between the rate at which energy can be supplied and the rate that is needed for maintenance. On the supply side, metabolic rate in organisms scales sublinearly with the number of cells, following the generic 3/4 power exponent derived from network constraints, while the demand increases approximately linearly. So, as the organism increases in size, demand eventually outstrips supply, because linear scaling grows faster than sublinear, with the consequence that the amount of energy available for growth continuously decreases, eventually going to zero, resulting in the cessation of growth. In other words, growth stops because of the mismatch between the way maintenance and supply scale as size increases. The sublinear scaling of metabolic rate and the associated economies of scale arising from optimizing network performance are therefore responsible for why growth stops and why biological systems exhibit the bounded sigmoidal growth curves that were shown in Chapter 4. The same network mechanism that underlies sublinear scaling, economies of scale, and the cessation of growth is also responsible for the systematic slowing down of the pace of biological life as size increases, and for eventual death. I now want to apply this framework to the growth of social organizations, beginning with cities. Because of its generality, it can be readily extended to companies and entire economies, which I shall discuss in the next chapter. As was explained in Chapter 7, cities are comprised of two generic components: their physical infrastructure, manifested as buildings, roads, etc., and their socio-economic dynamics, manifested as ideas, innovation, wealth creation, and social capital. Both are networked systems, and their tight interconnectivity and interdependence result in the approximate complementarity between the corresponding sub- and super-linear scaling laws, namely, that the 15% savings with every doubling of size in the former are approximately equal to the 15% gain in the latter. It is the first of these, the physical infrastructural component, that has close analogies to biology and provides the metaphor of the city as an organism. But, as I have persistently emphasized, the city is much more than its physicality. Consequently, the concept of metabolic rate as the supply-side input that fuels growth and sustains a city has to be expanded to include socio-economic activity. In addition to the electricity, gas, oil, water, materials, products, artifacts, and so on that are used and generated in a city, we have to add wealth, information, ideas, and social capital. At a more fundamental level, all of these, whether physical or socio-economic, are driven and sustained by the supply of energy. In addition to heating buildings, transporting materials and people, manufacturing goods, and providing gas, water, and electricity, every transaction, every dollar gained or lost, every conversation and meeting, every phone call and text message, every idea and every thought has to be fueled by energy. Furthermore, just as food must be metabolized into a form that is useful for supplying cells and sustaining life, so the incoming energy and resources digested by a city must be transformed into a form that can be used to supply, sustain, and grow socio-economic activities such as wealth creation, innovation, and the quality of life. No one has articulated this more eloquently than the great urbanist Lewis Mumford. The chief function of the city is to convert power into form, energy into culture, dead matter into the living symbols of art, biological reproduction into social creativity. This extraordinary process, which can be thought of as the social metabolism of a city, is responsible for increasing our conventional biological metabolic rate, derived from the food we eat, from just 2,000 food calories a day, or 100 watts, to about 11,000 watts, the equivalent of 2 million food calories a day. Thus, the actual energy content of the food input to the total energy budget of a city is a tiny portion of its overall consumption, less than 1%, and that's why I didn't include it in the above discussion, even though it is obviously a critical component of urban life. This may seem paradoxical, since we saw in the last section that food establishments are the most abundant business type in most cities, even exceeding lawyers. The point is that the overwhelming energy cost associated with food is not in the food itself, the 2,000 food calories a day per person, but in its production, transportation, distribution, and marketing through the supply chain from farms to stores to your house and ultimately to your mouth. When one contemplates the huge number of different contributions to the total metabolism of a city, it becomes clear that determining its value, whether in dollars or watts, becomes a major challenge that, as far as I know, has never been attempted in detail. This is quite surprising, given that this is fundamental to how cities, and more generally economies, function and grow. In addition to the need for collecting and analyzing huge amounts of data across a broad spectrum of diverse activities, there is the issue as to what should actually be counted as part of the social metabolism of a city. What are the independent contributions? Should we include, for instance, the energy costs of crime, police, patents, construction, investments and research as independent contributions? Or will we be double counting if we do, as there are clear overlaps and interconnections among and between them? For the purposes of understanding growth, however, this challenge can be elegantly finessed using the conceptual framework of our scaling theory. The critical point is that all socio-economic contributions to social metabolism that underlie growth, including wealth creation and innovation, scale in approximately the same way following the classic superlinear power law with a common exponent of approximately 1.15. Because all of its subcomponents scale this way, the total social metabolic rate of a city must likewise scale superlinearly with an exponent of 1.15. This is the beauty of the scaling perspective. We don't need to know the details of what the individual contributions to the metabolism of a city are in order to determine its growth trajectory. This is because they are all interconnected and interrelated through the same integrated unifying dynamics of the social and infrastructural networks that constitute urban life. The superlinear scaling of metabolism has profound consequences for growth. In contrast to the situation in biology, the supply of metabolic energy generated by cities as they grow increases faster than the needs and demands for its maintenance. Consequently, the amount available for growth, which is just the difference between its social metabolic rate and the requirements for maintenance, continues to increase as the city gets larger. The bigger the city gets, the faster it grows, a classic signal of open-ended exponential growth. A mathematical analysis indeed confirms that growth driven by superlinear scaling is actually faster than exponential. In fact, it's super-exponential. Even though the conceptual and mathematical structure of the growth equation is the same for organisms, social insect communities, and cities, the consequences are quite different. Sublinear scaling and economies of scale that dominate biology lead to stable, bounded growth and the slowing down of the pace of life, whereas superlinear scaling and increasing returns to scale that dominate socio-economic activity lead to unbounded growth and to an accelerating pace of life. The continuous positive feedback mechanisms inherent in social networks that are responsible for the multiplicative enhancement of social connectivity and superlinear scaling lead naturally to open-ended super-exponential growth and concomitantly to an increase in the pace of life. This is what has evolved over the past couple of hundred years as cities have exploded on the planet. Some examples from across the globe include Old World cities, London, New World cities, New York, Austin, several California cities and Mexico City, and Asian cities, Bombay. The major point I want to stress here is that the growth equation driven by superlinear scaling leads to a mathematical formula whose predictions are consistent with generic super-exponential growth. However, both London and New York show periods of contraction and stagnation. I will return to discuss these effects in Chapter 10, where I'll pick up the story on open-ended growth in a larger context by relating it to the role of innovation cycles and the accelerating pace of life, and how these affect the critical question of sustainability. Chapter 9. Toward a Science of Companies. Companies, like people and households, are fundamental elements of the socio-economic life of cities and states. Innovation, wealth generation, entrepreneurship, and job creation are all manifested through the formation and growth of businesses, firms, and corporations, all of which I shall refer to generically as companies. Companies dominate the economy. For example, the total worth of all publicly traded companies in the United States, technically referred to as their total market capitalization, is more than $21 trillion, which is more than 15% larger than the entire GDP. The value and annual sales of any of the very largest companies, such as Walmart, Shell, Exxon, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft, approach $500 billion, $500 billion, implying that a relatively small number of them have the lion's share of the total market. Given our previous revelations concerning the rank and size frequency distributions of personal incomes, Pareto's law, and cities, Zipf's law, it will come as no great surprise to learn that this lopsidedness is a reflection of a similar power law distribution for the ranking of companies in terms of their market capitalization or annual sales. This was already shown in Chapter 8. Thus, there are very few extremely large companies, but an enormous number of very small ones, with all of those in between following a simple, systematic power law distribution. So, while there are almost 30 million independent businesses in the United States, most of which are private with very few employees, there are only about 4,000 publicly traded companies, and these constitute the bulk of economic activity. Given this observation, it is natural to ask, as we did for cities and organisms, whether companies scale in terms of their measurable metrics, such as their sales, assets, expenses, and profits. Do companies manifest systematic regularities that transcend their size, individuality, and business sector? And if so, could there possibly be a quantitative, predictive science of companies, paralleling the science of cities that was developed in previous chapters? Is it possible to understand the general quantitative features of their life histories, how they grow, mature, and eventually die? As with cities, there is an extensive body of literature on companies stretching back to Adam Smith and the founding of modern economics. Much of the work is qualitative, often gathered through case studies of specific companies or business sectors, from which the general dynamical and organizational features of companies are intuited. Historically, companies have been viewed as the necessary agents that organize people to work collaboratively to take advantage of economies of scale, thereby reducing the transaction costs of production or services between the manufacturer or provider and the consumer. The drive to minimize costs so as to maximize profits and gain greater market share has been extraordinarily successful in creating the modern market economy by providing goods and services at affordable prices to vast numbers of people. Despite all of its pitfalls, abuses, and negative unintended consequences, this free market credo has been instrumental in creating an unprecedented standard of living across the globe. It is potentially a harsh and simplistic vision that often ignores quality, and, more important, the role of explicit corporate social responsibility as a basic complementary component for why companies exist beyond the primitive drive to maximize profits and compensation. Most of the literature on companies has been developed from the vantage point of economics, finance, law, and organizational studies, though in more recent years, ideas from ecology and evolutionary biology have begun to gain prominence. There is also a large popular literature written by successful investors and CEOs revealing the secrets of their own success, which they tend to extrapolate to explain and prescribe what makes some companies successful and others failures. To varying degrees, all of these provide insights into the nature, dynamics, and structure of companies, but none brings a broad scientific perspective to the problem in the sense that I have been using in this book. The mechanisms that have traditionally been suggested for understanding companies can be divided into three broad categories: transaction costs, organizational structure, and competition in the marketplace. Although these are interrelated, they have very often been treated separately. In the language of the framework developed in previous chapters, these can be expressed as follows. 1. Minimizing transaction costs reflects economies of scale driven by an optimization principle, such as maximizing profits. 2. Organizational structure is the network system within a company that conveys information, resources, and capital to support, sustain, and grow the enterprise. 3. Competition results in the evolutionary pressures and selection processes inherent in the ecology of the marketplace. Automobiles, computers, ballpoint pens, and insurance portfolios cannot be produced on a grand scale without creating a complex organizational structure, which must be adaptive if it is going to survive in a competitive market. As in cities, this necessitates the integration of energy, resources, and capital, the metabolism of the company, with the exchange of information in order to fuel innovation and creativity. In this sense, companies at all scales are classic, complex, adaptive systems, and it is this framework, rooted in the scaling paradigm, that I want to explore. To what extent can a quantitative, mechanistic theory for understanding their growth, longevity, and organization be developed that is complementary to traditional ways of viewing them? There have been surprisingly few studies on the nature of companies using large datasets spanning the entire spectrum of economic activities and company histories. Most of these have been carried out by researchers inspired by ideas from complex systems, a good example of which is the discovery that the size distribution of companies follows the systematic Zipf-like power law. This insight was made by the computational social scientist Robert Axtell, who was trained in public policy and computer science at Carnegie Mellon University, where he came under the influence of the great polymath Herbert Simon, whom I mentioned earlier. Axtell, who was at George Mason University in Virginia and is also on the external faculty of the Santa Fe Institute, is a leading expert in agent-based modeling, which is a computational technique used for simulating systems composed of huge numbers of components. Basically, the strategy involves postulating simple rules governing the interactions between individual constituent agents, which could be companies, cities, or people, coupled with an algorithm that specifies how they evolve in time and letting the resulting system run on a computer. More sophisticated versions include rules for learning, adaptation, and even reproduction, so as to model more realistic evolutionary processes. With the development of powerful computers, agent-based modeling has become a standard tool for gaining insight into many problems in ecological and social systems, such as modeling the structure of terrorist organizations, the internet, traffic patterns, stock market behavior, pandemics, ecosystem dynamics, and business strategies. Over the past few years, Axtell has used agent-based modeling to try to simulate the entire ecosystem of companies in the United States, encompassing more than 6 million companies and 120 million workers. This ambitious project relies heavily on census data, both as input to constrain the simulation and to test its outcomes. More recently, he has teamed up with other prominent members of the SFI community, including Doyne Farmer, now a professor at Oxford, and John Giannakopoulos, a well-known economist at Yale, to extend this project to try to simulate the entire economy. This is truly ambitious, requiring enormous amounts of input data on everything from financial transactions and industrial production to real estate, government spending, taxes, business investments, foreign trade and investments, and even consumer behavior. The hope is that such an integrated simulation of the whole economy could provide a realistic testbed for evaluating different strategies for economic stimulus, such as whether to reduce taxes or increase public spending, and perhaps most important, to be able to predict tipping points or forecast imminent crises so as to avoid potential recessions or even eventual collapse. It is sobering that no such detailed model for how the economy actually works exists, and that policy is typically determined by relatively localized, sometimes intuitive, ideas of how it should work. Very little of the thinking explicitly acknowledges that the economy is an ever-evolving, complex, adaptive system, and that deconstructing its multitudinous interdependent components into finer and finer semi-autonomous subsystems can lead to misleading, even dangerous conclusions, as testified by the history of economic forecasting. Like long-term weather forecasting, this is a notoriously difficult challenge, and to be fair to economists, we should recognize that they are pretty good at forecasting the relatively short term, provided the system remains stable. Traditional economic theory relies heavily on the economy remaining in an approximately equilibrium state. The serious challenge is to be able to predict outlying events, major transitions, critical points, and devastating economic hurricanes and tornadoes, where their record has mostly been pretty dismal. Nassim Taleb, author of the best-selling, highly influential book The Black Swan, has been particularly harsh on economists, despite, or maybe because of, having been trained in business and finance. He has held positions at several distinguished universities, including New York University and Oxford, and has focused on the importance of coming to terms with outlying events and developing a deeper understanding of risk. He has been brutally outspoken in his condemnation of classical economic thinking, with hyperbolic comments such as, "Years ago, I noticed one thing about economics, and that is that economists didn't get anything right." He has even called for the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics to be withdrawn, saying that the damage from economic theories can be devastating. I may disagree with some of Taleb's ideas and polemics, but it's important and healthy to have such outspoken mavericks challenging the orthodoxy, especially when it's had such a poor record and its proclamations have major implications for our lives. The great virtue of agent-based modeling is its potential for providing an alternative framework for addressing some of these big issues by treating the entire system as an integrated entity rather than as a sum of its idealized bits and pieces. It recognizes upfront that the economy is typically not in equilibrium, but is an evolving system with emergent properties that result from the underlying interactions between its multiple constituent parts. It does, however, have some serious shortcomings. To begin with, a crucial input is the specification of the rules for how agents behave, interact, and make decisions. And in many cases, this has to be based on intuition rather than on fundamental knowledge or principles. Furthermore, it is often very difficult to interpret the results of a detailed simulation and determine the causal relationships between different components and subunits of the system. It can therefore be unclear what the important drivers are that determine specific outputs versus those that are consequences of general principles common to all such systems. In its extreme version, the underlying philosophy of agent-based modeling is antithetical to the traditional scientific framework, where the primary challenge is to reduce huge numbers of seemingly disparate and disconnected observations down to a few basic general principles or laws. As in biology, where the principle of natural selection applies to all organisms, from cells to whales, or in physics, where Newton's laws apply to all motion, from automobiles to planets. In contrast, the aim of agent-based modeling is to construct an almost one-to-one mapping of each specific system. General laws and principles that constrain its structure and dynamics play a secondary role. For example, in simulating a specific company, Every individual worker, administrator, transaction, sale, cost, etc. is in effect included, and each company consequently treated as a separate, almost unique entity, typically without explicit regard either to its systematic behavior or its relationship to the bigger picture. Clearly, both approaches are needed. The generality and parsimony of universal laws and systematic behavior reflecting the big picture and dominant forces shaping general behavior, coupled with and informed by detailed modeling reflecting the individuality and uniqueness of each company. In the case of cities, scaling laws revealed that 80 to 90% of their measurable characteristics are determined from just knowing their population size, with the remaining 10 to 20% being a measure of their individuality and uniqueness, which can be understood only from detailed studies that incorporate local historical, geographical, and cultural characteristics. It is in this spirit that I now want to explore to what extent this framework can be used to reveal emergent laws obeyed by companies. 1. Is Walmart a scaled-up Big Joe's Lumber and Google a great big bear? The financial services company Standard & Poor's, best known for its stock market index of U.S.-based companies, the S&P 500, provides a valuable database of all publicly traded companies going back to 1950, with summaries of their financial statements and balance sheets. It's called CompuStat. Unlike analogous databases for organisms and cities, this database does not come for free. S&P wants about $50,000 for access to it. That may be chicken feed to most investors, corporations, and business schools for whom it is intended. But for us mere academics, it's a lot of money, equivalent to the annual salary of a postdoc. Unfortunately, when we organized the ISCOM project to study companies from a scaling perspective, we didn't have that kind of money available, so the study of companies had to go on the back burner, and the focus of the project was instead directed to cities, where data came for free. The city work proved to be much more exciting and productive than I, for one, had foreseen, and it took much longer than anticipated to return to thinking about companies with the kind of focus the subject deserved, even after we had eventually gained access to the CompuStat database via explorative funding from the National Science Foundation. Partly because of this, the analysis and the theoretical framework are less developed than for cities. Nevertheless, significant headway has been made, and a coherent picture has emerged to provide the foundations of a coarse-grained science of companies. The modern concept of a company, and the kind of rapid market turnover we see today, in which most companies don't survive for very long, has been around for only the last couple of hundred years at most. This is a much shorter time period than the many hundreds or even thousands of years that cities and urban systems have been evolving, and in marked contrast to the billions of years that biological life has been thriving. Consequently, there has been much less time for the market forces that act on companies to reach the kind of metastable configuration manifested in the systematic scaling laws obeyed by cities and organisms. As explained in earlier chapters, scaling laws are a consequence of the optimization of the network structures that sustain these various systems, resulting from the continuous feedback mechanisms inherent in natural selection and the survival of the fittest. In the case of cities, we would therefore expect the emergent scaling laws to exhibit much greater variance around idealized power laws than organisms do, because the time over which evolutionary forces have acted is so much shorter. Comparing fits to scaling in animal metabolic rates versus the patent production in cities confirms this prediction. There is a consistently larger spread around the fits for cities than for organisms. Extrapolating this to companies where evolutionary timescales are even shorter suggests that if they do indeed scale, there should be an even greater spread in the data around idealized scaling curves than for cities and organisms. The CompuStat dataset used for the analysis consists of all 28,853 companies that were traded on US markets in the 60 years between 1950 and 2009. The database includes standard accounting measures such as the number of employees, total sales, assets, expenses, and liabilities, each broken down into subcategories that include interest expenses, investments, inventory, depreciation, and so on. It was constructed by Marcus Hamilton, a young anthropologist whom we had hired as a postdoc to help lead this effort. Even as a student, Marcus had a mission in life: to make anthropology and archaeology more quantitative, computational, and mechanistic. For good reasons, these fields have been among the least of the social sciences in appreciating this perspective, so Marcus has had a tough journey. But for us, he was perfect. After getting his doctorate, he worked with Jim Brown on global sustainability issues from an ecological and anthropological viewpoint before joining us at SFI. He has pioneered some fascinating work on trying to understand hunter-gatherer societies from our scaling perspective, and together with Jose Lobo and me, has been developing a theory for how and why our hunter-gatherer ancestors made the crucial transition to sedentary communities that eventually led to city formation. Together with Jose and Marcus, I recently co-authored a paper that was published in a leading anthropology journal, one of the crowning achievements of my career. The initial results and conclusions of our investigation into the scaling of companies are very compelling. They provide a powerful basis for developing an understanding of their generic structure and life histories. The sales, incomes, and assets of all 28,853 companies can be plotted logarithmically against their number of employees. These are the dominant financial characteristics of any company and are standard measures of their fiscal health and dynamics. Companies do indeed scale following simple power laws, and as anticipated, they do so with a much greater spread around their average behavior than for either cities or organisms. So, in this statistical sense, companies are approximately scaled, self-similar versions of one another. Walmart is an approximately scaled-up version of a much smaller, modest-sized company. Even after taking this greater variance into account, this scaling result reveals remarkable regularities in the size and dynamics of companies, and is quite surprising given the tremendous variety of different business sectors, locations, and age. Before expounding further on this, it's instructive to examine how scaling regularities are extracted from big datasets having a large variance such as these. A standard strategy is to bin the data into a series of equal intervals, much like a histogram, and then take the average within each interval. This effectively averages over the fluctuations and reduces the large number of data points to a relatively small number, which is just the number of bins used to divide up the entire interval. The number of employees ranges by a factor of more than a million from the very smallest, mostly young companies with few employees, up to giants like Walmart with more than a million. To illustrate the procedure, the data on income, profits, assets, and sales have been binned into 8 equal intervals, each covering a single order of magnitude. Thus, the first bin includes all companies with fewer than 10 employees, the second all those with 10 to 100, the third all those with 100 to 1,000, and so on, the last bin containing all those with more than a million employees. The 6 points resulting from averaging over each bin represent a highly coarse-grained reduction of the data, and as you can see, follow a very good straight line supporting the idea that underlying the statistical spread is an idealized power law. Because the size and number of bins used is arbitrary, we could just as well have divided up the entire interval into 10, 50, or 100 bins, rather than just 8, and test whether the straight line remains robust against increasingly finer resolutions of the data. It does. Although binning is not a rigorous mathematical procedure, the stability of obtaining approximately the same straight-line fit using different resolutions lends strong support to the hypothesis that, on average, companies are self-similar and satisfy power law scaling. The result of this binning procedure from Axtell's work shows that companies follow Zipf's law. These results strongly suggest that companies, like cities and organisms, obey universal dynamics that transcend their individuality and uniqueness, and that a coarse-grained science of companies is conceivable. Additional evidence supporting this discovery came from an unlikely source, namely the Chinese stock market. In 2012, Zhang Zhang, a young faculty member in the School of Systems Science at Beijing Normal University, joined our collaboration. Jake, as he is known to most of us, visited SFI in 2010 and became enthusiastic about getting involved in the company project. He had access to a database similar to CompuStat, covering all Chinese companies participating in their emerging stock market. Following the collapse of the Cultural Revolution and the rise to power of Deng Xiaoping, economic reform led to the re-establishment of a securities market in China, and at the end of 1991, the Shanghai Stock Exchange opened for business. When Jake analyzed the data, he found, to our great satisfaction, that Chinese companies scaled in a similar fashion to U.S. companies. This, however, came as something of a surprise, considering that the Chinese market had been in operation for less than 15 years. Apparently, in a vigorous fast-track setting, competitive free market dynamics are sufficiently potent for systematic trends to begin to emerge relatively quickly. This is no doubt related to the extraordinarily rapid pace at which the Chinese stock market and its overall economy have grown in such a short time. The Shanghai Exchange is already the fifth largest in the world, and in Asia is second only to Hong Kong's. Its total market capitalization is $3.5 trillion, compared to more than $21 trillion for the New York Stock Exchange and $7 trillion for Hong Kong's. 2. The myth of open-ended growth. A crucial aspect of the scaling of companies is that many of their key metrics scale sublinearly, like organisms, rather than superlinearly, like cities. This suggests that companies are more like organisms than cities, and are dominated by a version of economies of scale, rather than by increasing returns and innovation. This has profound implications for their life history, and in particular, for their growth and mortality. As we saw in Chapter 4, sublinear scaling in biology leads to bounded growth and a finite lifespan, whereas in Chapter 8, we saw that the superlinear scaling of cities and of economies leads to open-ended growth. Their sublinear scaling therefore suggests that companies also eventually stop growing and ultimately die, hardly the image that many CEOs would cherish. It's actually not quite as simple as that, because the prediction for the growth of companies is more subtle than just a simple extrapolation from biology. To explain this, I am going to present a simplified version of how the general theory applies to companies, focusing on the essential features that determine their growth and mortality. The sustained growth of a company is ultimately fueled by its profits, or net revenue, where these are defined as the difference between sales, or total income, and total expenses. Expenses include salaries, costs, interest payments, and so on. To continue growth over a prolonged period, companies must eventually return a profit, part of which is sometimes used to pay dividends to shareholders. Together with other investors, they in turn may buy additional stocks and bonds to help support the future health and growth of the company. However, to understand their generic behavior, it is more transparent to ignore dividends and investments, which are primarily important for smaller, younger companies, and concentrate on profits, which are the dominant driver of growth for larger ones. As we've seen, growth in both organisms and cities is fueled by the difference between metabolism and maintenance. Using that language, the total income or sales of a company can be thought of as its metabolism, while expenses can be thought of as its maintenance costs. In biology, metabolic rate scales sublinearly with size. So as organisms increase in size, the supply of energy cannot keep up with the maintenance demands of cells, leading to the eventual cessation of growth. On the other hand, the social metabolic rate in cities scales superlinearly. So as cities grow, the creation of social capital increasingly outpaces the demands of maintenance, leading to faster and faster open-ended growth. So, how does this dynamic play out in companies? Intriguingly, companies manifest yet another variation on this general theme by following a path that sits at the cusp between organisms and cities. Their effective metabolic rate is neither sub nor superlinear, but falls right in the middle by being linear. Where sales are plotted logarithmically against the number of employees, it shows a best fit with a slope very close to 1. Expenses, on the other hand, scale in a more complicated fashion. They start out sublinearly, but as companies become larger, eventually transition to becoming approximately linear. Consequently, the difference between sales and expenses, which is the driver of growth, also eventually scales approximately linearly. This is good news, because mathematically, linear scaling leads to exponential growth, and this is what all companies strive for. Furthermore, this also shows why, on average, the economy continues to expand at an exponential rate, because the overall performance of the market is effectively an average over the growth performances of all its individual participating companies. Although this may be good news for the overall economy, it sets a major challenge for each individual company, because each one has to keep up with an exponentially expanding market. So, even if a company is growing exponentially, the good news, this may not be sufficient for it to survive, unless its expansion rate is at least that of the market. The bad news. This primitive version of the survival of the fittest for companies is the essence of the free market economy. More good news is that the non-linear scaling of maintenance expenses in younger companies, buoyed by investments and the ability to borrow large amounts relative to their size, fuels their rapid growth. Consequently, the idealized growth curve of companies has characteristics in common with classic sigmoidal growth in biology, in that it starts out relatively rapidly, but slows down as companies become larger and maintenance expenses transition to becoming linear. However, unlike biology, whose maintenance costs do not transition to linearity, companies do not cease growing, but continue to grow exponentially, though at a more modest rate. Let's see how this scenario compares with data. The growth of sales for all 28,853 companies in the CompuStat dataset plotted together in real calendar time, adjusted for inflation. The overall trend is clear. As predicted, many young companies shoot out of the starter's block and grow rapidly before slowing down, while older, more mature ones that have survived continue growing but at a much slower rate. Furthermore, the upward trends of these older, slower-growing companies all follow an approximate straight line. A straight line means, mathematically, that sales are growing exponentially with time. Thus, on average, all surviving companies eventually settle down to a steady but slow exponential growth, as predicted. This is very encouraging. But there's a potential pitfall that becomes apparent when the growth of each company is measured relative to the growth of the overall market. In that case, where the overall growth of the market has been factored out, all large mature companies have stopped growing. Their growth curves, when corrected for both inflation and the expansion of the market, now look just like typical sigmoidal growth curves of organisms, in which growth ceases at maturity, as illustrated in Chapter 4. This close similarity with the growth of organisms, when viewed in this way, provides a natural segue into whether this similarity extends to mortality, and whether, like us, all companies are destined to die. 3. The surprising simplicity of company mortality. After growing rapidly in their youth, almost all companies with sales over about $10 million end up floating on top of the ripples of the stock market. Of these, many operate with their metaphorical noses just above the surface. This is a precarious situation because if a big wave comes along, they may well drown. Even with profits growing exponentially, let alone if they are suffering losses, companies become vulnerable if they are unable to keep up with the growth of the market. This is greatly exacerbated if a company is not sufficiently robust to withstand the continual ups and downs inherent in the market, as well as in its own finances. A sizable fluctuation in the market, or some unexpected external perturbation or shock at the wrong time, can be devastating to a company whose sales and expenses are finely balanced. This may lead to a contraction and decline from which a company might recover, but in severe cases, it can be devastating and lead to its demise. This sequence of events probably sounds familiar because it's not so very different from the process that leads to our own death. We, too, are finely balanced between metabolism and maintenance costs, a condition biologists refer to as homeostasis. The gradual build-up of unrepaired damage resulting from the wear and tear inherent in the process of living makes us less resilient and increasingly vulnerable to fluctuations and perturbations as we age. A case of the flu or pneumonia or a heart attack or stroke that might have been handled in youth and throughout midlife is often fatal once we have reached old age. Ultimately, we reach a stage where even a small perturbation, such as a minor cold or heart flutter, can lead to death. While this image provides a useful metaphor for the mortality of companies, it represents only part of the picture. To dig a little deeper, we must first define what we mean by death of a company, because many of them disappear by mergers or acquisitions rather than by liquidating or going bankrupt. A useful definition is to use sales as the indicator of a company's viability, the idea being that if it's metabolizing, then it's alive. Thus, birth is defined as the time when a company first reports sales, and death as the time when it ceases to do so. With this definition, companies may die through a variety of processes. They may split, merge, or liquidate as economic and technological conditions change. While liquidation is often responsible for the death of companies, a much more common cause is their disappearance through mergers and acquisitions. Of the 28,853 companies that have traded on U.S. markets since 1950, 22,469, 78%, had died by 2009. Of these, 45% were acquired by or merged with other companies, while only about 9% went bankrupt or were liquidated, 3% privatized, 0.5% underwent leveraged buyouts, 0.5% went through reverse acquisitions, and the remainder disappeared for other reasons. Let's look at the survivorship and mortality curves for companies that were born and died within the period covered by the dataset, 1950 to 2009, as a function of how long they lived. The curves have been separated into bankruptcies and liquidations on the one hand, and into acquisitions and mergers on the other, and then further deconstructed according to the size of their sales. As can clearly be seen, the general structure of these curves is almost the same regardless of how the data are sliced, even when companies are separated into individual business sectors. In all cases, the number of survivors falls rapidly immediately following their initial public offering, with fewer than 5% remaining alive after 30 years. Similarly, the mortality curves show that the number that have died reaches almost 100% within 50 years, with almost half of them having already disappeared in less than 10. It's tough being a company. The survival curves are well approximated by a simple exponential, where the number of companies that have survived is plotted logarithmically versus their age. Plotted this way, exponentials appear as straight lines. You might have thought that these results would depend sensitively on whether death occurred via mergers and acquisitions rather than from bankruptcies and liquidations. However, as you can see, they both follow very similar exponential survival curves with only slightly different values for their mortality. One might also have expected the results to depend on which business sector a company is in. The dynamics and competitive market forces would seem to be quite different, for instance, in the energy sector compared with IT, transportation or finance. Surprisingly, however, all business sectors show similar characteristic exponential survival curves with similar timescales. No matter which sector or what the stated cause is, only about half of the companies survive for more than 10 years. This is consistent with an analysis showing that companies scale in approximately the same way when broken down into separate business categories. Within each sector, power laws are obtained, having exponents close to those found for the entire cohort of companies. In other words, the general dynamics and overall life history of companies are effectively independent of the business sector in which they operate. This strongly suggests that there is indeed a universal dynamic at play that determines their coarse-grained behavior independent of their commercial activity, or whether they are eventually going to go bankrupt, or merge with, or be bought by another company. In a word, this strongly supports the idea of a quantitative science of companies. This is really quite amazing. After all, when we think of the birth, death, and general life history of companies as they struggle to establish and maintain themselves in the marketplace, dealing with the vagaries, uncertainties, and unpredictability of economic life, and the myriad specific decisions and accidents that led to the successes and failures that preceded their death, it's hard to believe that collectively they were following such simple, general rules. This revelation echoes the surprise that organisms, ecosystems, and cities are likewise subject to generic constraints, despite the apparent uniqueness and individuality of their life histories. Exponential survival curves, similar to those exhibited by companies, are manifested in many other collective systems, such as bacterial colonies, animals and plants, and even the decay of radioactive materials. It is also believed that the mortality of prehistoric humans followed these curves before they became sedentary social creatures, reaping the benefits derived from community structures and social organization. Our modern survival curve has evolved from being a classic exponential to developing a long plateau stretching over 50 years, as illustrated in Chapter 4, showing that we now live much longer on average than our hunter-gatherer forebears, even though our maximum lifespan has remained pretty much what it always was. What is the special property of exponentials that they describe the decay of so many disparate systems? It's simply that they arise whenever the death rate at any given time is directly proportional to the number that are still alive. This is equivalent to saying that the percentage of survivors that die within equal slices of time at any age remains the same. A simple example will make this clear. Taking 1 year as the time slice, this says that the percentage of 5-year-old companies that die before they reach 6 years old is the same as the percentage of 50-year-old companies that die before they reach 51. In other words, the risk of a company's dying does not depend on its age or size. A lingering issue of possible concern is that the data cover only 60 years, so companies older than this are automatically excluded. Actually, it's worse than this because the analysis includes only those companies that were born and died in the time window between 1950 and 2009, thereby excluding all those that were born before 1950 and or were still alive in 2009. This could clearly lead to a systemic bias in the estimates of life expectancy. A more complete analysis therefore needs to include these so-called censored companies, whose lifespans are at least as long as, and likely longer than, the period over which they appear in the dataset. This actually involves a sizable number of companies. In the 60 years covered, 6,873 firms were still alive at the end of the window in 2009. Fortunately, there is a well-established, sophisticated methodology called survival analysis that has been developed precisely for addressing this issue. Survival analysis was developed in medicine in order to estimate survival probabilities for patients who have undergone therapeutic interventions under test conditions. These tests serve necessarily to be conducted over a limited time period, leading to the problem we face here, namely that many subjects die after the test period has ended. The technique commonly used, called the Kaplan-Meier estimator, employs the entire dataset and optimizes probabilities, assuming that each death event is statistically independent of every other death. A detailed analysis using this technique was carried out for the complete cohort of companies in the CompuStat dataset, including all those that were previously censored, with the result that there was only a modest change from the previous censored estimates. The half-life of U.S. publicly traded companies was found to be close to 10.5 years, meaning that half of all companies that began trading in any given year have disappeared in 10.5 years. Most of the hard work on this was done by an undergraduate intern, Madeline Depp, who joined us under the aegis of a wonderful program called Research Experience for Undergraduates, REU, funded primarily by the NSF. This provides support for undergraduates to spend a summer working in real-life research at institutions across the entire spectrum of scientific activity. At SFI, we usually have about 10 such bright young minds on site, all of whom are treated as equal members of the institute and who work closely with individual researchers. It's a great experience for both us and them. Madeline was a junior in mathematics at Washington University in St. Louis when she joined us and worked under the direct supervision of Marcus Hamilton. It's hard to complete such a project from scratch in just 10 weeks, so Madeline returned several times over the ensuing 3 years before the work was eventually completed and a successful paper published. I was delighted to learn just recently that she has been accepted to the PhD program in urban planning at MIT, which is one of the best in the world. I expect to hear great things of her in the future. The survival analysis technique used for dealing with incomplete observations, such as we have here, was invented in 1958 by two statisticians, Edward Kaplan and Paul Meyer. It has since been extended to areas outside of medicine and used to estimate, for example, how long people can expect to remain unemployed after a job loss, or how long it takes for machine parts to fail. Amusingly, Kaplan and Meyer each submitted similar but independent papers to the prestigious Journal of the American Statistical Association for publication, and a wise editor persuaded them to combine them into a single paper. This has since been cited in other scholarly papers more than 34,000 times, which is an extremely large number for an academic paper. For instance, Stephen Hawking's most famous paper, Particle Creation by Black Holes, has been cited less than 5,000 times. Depending on the field, most papers are fortunate to receive even 25 citations. Several of my own that I thought were pretty damn good have been cited less than 10 times, which is pretty discouraging, although I am a co-author of two of the most cited papers in ecology, each having more than 3,000 citations. 4. Requiescant in pace. Although there are significant differences, it's hard not to be struck by how similar the growth and death of companies and organisms are when viewed through the lens of scaling, and how dissimilar they both are to cities. Companies are surprisingly biological, and from an evolutionary perspective, their mortality is an important ingredient for generating innovative vitality resulting from creative destruction and the survival of the fittest. Just as all organisms must die in order that the new and novel may blossom, so it is that all companies disappear or morph to allow new, innovative variations to flourish. Better to have the excitement and innovation of a Google or Tesla than the stagnation of a geriatric IBM or General Motors. This is the underlying culture of the free market system. The great turnover of companies, and especially the continual churning of mergers and acquisitions, are integral to the market process. And of course this means that the Googles and Teslas, which may seem invincible now, will themselves eventually fade away and disappear. From this point of view, we should not lament the past